Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 20th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Dean Waldo, who will be continuing his series on plastics. Today's session is number 3 and is titled, Plastics, How Are They Made and Remade? Let's listen in.
Session to combine the Dan Spencer, the last night's session, and modern materials. Okay, you might want to roll the tape. My name is Dean Waldo, and today's session is Plastics, How Are They Made and Remade? This is sort of the third in an ongoing series of sessions, and I'm just going to do a little review to sort of put in perspective for people who may not have heard the other two sessions. And well, I guess I should introduce myself a little bit more. I'm a chemistry professor at Pacific Lutheran University, and my background is primarily in synthetic polymer blends and polymers. I study very basic scientific properties and physical properties of those. I was asked to come into Holden and teach. I thought if I talked about that, I might end up being asked to leave. So I actually gave me a chance to learn a lot more about the more practical aspects of how plastics are being used and things like that. I'm on the Holden Science and Technology Committee, which meets one or two times a year and tries to help in consultation with various science, technology, engineering type of questions. I would encourage you to keep talking, ask questions, interrupt, make me have to remember where I was at, so that, you know, it's just not a lecture and hopefully won't get too lecture-ish. But I've got a conglomerate of information. We don't have to talk about it all, or we can talk about it all, or answer whatever questions you folks have. Sort of put it in a perspective of this group of sessions I've been having. The first session, I talked a little bit about an overview of plastics recycling. Tried to talk about what plastics were, why perhaps they're sort of the latecomer to recycling, and why they're harder to recycle. And the basic gist of that was that there are 150, 200 different what are called resins that go into plastics to make them. And they can be very hard to, you just can't put them all in a pot and heat them up, mix them up and make a new plastic, because they are very different molecules in terms of their chemistry and physical properties, and they don't like to mix. Yesterday, we looked at these resins to try to understand what are some of the properties. And so we did a few experiments, and one experiment failed. I've got to see if I can find a hot plate. I didn't want to go in the kitchen and do the chemistry mixing, so I thought that would be very kind. But the one solution didn't mix up well, so I've got to see if I can heat that up, and maybe tomorrow we can do that, or Saturday or something. So we looked at the properties of why these different plastics have different properties, and we discovered that if you cool high-density polyethylene, it becomes very brittle and can shatter just like glass. And what I did is I put liquid nitrogen, which is liquefied, basically atmosphere, in there. It's very, very cold, 77 degrees Kelvin. It cooled down this plastic until it was a very solid. A slight tap of a hammer resulted in flying high-density polyethylene. So just to illustrate that, if you change the temperature, a plastic will behave very differently. If you're familiar with the, pretty much everyone maybe even remembers where they were when the Challenger, the shuttle Challenger, blew up, and that was primarily caused by a polymer undergoing a transition from a rubber material to a glassy material and then becoming very brittle and not being able to hold the pressure of a seal. And the polymer community that I was a part of was kind of frustrated that They put a physicist on the panel of this team to tell them about a polymer's glass transition temperature, which is that temperature where it goes from a liquid to a solid. But it was really quite a tragic event and could have been taken care of very simply by a little heat and more knowledge of that. But so properties of plastics are very important in the way they're used. We talked about what polymers were. They're very long chain molecules. And this is a very minuscule section of a polymer molecule, which would be a resin that goes into a plastic. And they have repeat units that they have poly, meaning many mers. And so that sort of brings us up to where we were yesterday in a very quick fashion. But then today what I was interested in talking about is a little bit of how plastics are made and how are they remade or recycled and some of the issues and costs and thoughts that go with that. But any questions? Boy, you get off the sex topic and boy, conversation just goes all the way. Well, just say a little bit about the process of making a plastic first. So if you were going to go into a factory and see them make a bunch of Nancy's low-fat yogurt containers, what they would be doing is they take a material that's called a resin, and that's this polymer molecule. It was synthesized someplace. They then add to that lots of other, what I have my notes are other stuff. Things to affect properties, affect the longevity of it, and affect if you put it in the sun, will not decompose. So what they do is they have this, usually it's powder or granulated resin, and the resins, let's take a chart from
where they've got plastics now that you can add things to that where they will deteriorate after a very short half-life, right?
There are more materials like that.
They'll actually sort of go away.
Yeah, they're getting more of those. It's quite often what they'll do is add starch or cellulose to a plastic, which is a more naturally occurring plastic and or polymer. And that allows a lot of biological entities to sort of find lunch and chew on them and degrade them and convert them back to things that are smaller molecules and can easily be converted back into carbon dioxide and water and sort of complete a biological cycle. But many plastics and aren't able to do that. You generally want to make them so they last and are resistant to those types of forces, which is good and sort of the bad idea, because then it's once you want to get rid of it, it's pretty hard if you want to use that type of setting. There are some polyesters, natural rubber, cellulose, starch. If you've seen these packing material, it looks like styrofoam peanuts, mm-hmm. but they're these. Yeah, they're made out of starch. It's essentially popcorn type stuff, which is, I think, a really nice advance in the idea of packaging, because then you can just dissolve it in water. You can compost it if you wanted to. What I was going to just show.
Are you talking about the regular stuff that's wrapped around like a radio in a box or something that is popcorn appearance stuff?
No, not the kind with the bubbles, but the actual little nuggets.
Yeah, but there's little things
there. Individual pieces that
are about this long. Kind of.
Wonder why they don't say that all of those packing things have to be the Everett way. Yeah.
Well,
it's not the kind that you step on.
You can't get water on it. Otherwise, so if you're in a setting where there might be a little water vapor you might lose the ability to withstand an impact, and so it really depends on the application and how you're going to use it. But like at PLU, we recycle those packing things. We have big bins of them, and if you need to ship things back, we have a supply to ship them back, and it goes back and forth. But so what I wanted to show you here in a very light fashion.
We're going to be a test on this one?
Yes, you must memorize each name. The only thing I want you to see here is there's about 25 to 30 lines. And each name there, you see, are various kinds of resins that you can buy or manufacturers use to produce products. And there are only 6 that are in the recycling label. The number 7, if you see the little 3-legged recycling arrow, that means the other 193 varieties of resins are packed into that. But in some sense, those 6 that they've picked are usually the highest use resins. And this just has lots of data about billions of pounds produced each year. And there are, in 90, there are about 60 billion pounds of plastic resins produced.
Is the base material for most of the resins petroleum products, or are there other things as well?
Most of them are based on petroleum products. It ends up being about 2 to somewhere between 2 and 8% of petroleum use goes towards plastics production. Most of petroleum use goes to automotive fuel, diesel fuel, heating oil. Goes to automotive oil, lubrication oils. And that's where the vast majority of petroleum products goes. Despite the volume we see, you know, if we're using 61 billion pounds of plastics, that's maybe, if we are generous, say 10% of the petroleum use, then we're burning up a lot of petroleum in many other ways. So it's amazing just the volume that we're using.
Is there any broad figure you use on the portion that's recyclable and isn't?
Well, of those plastics that are labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, the polystyrene, the polyethylene terephthalate, polypropylene, the polyethylenes, polystyrene, did I say that one right? Those are technically, scientifically, engineering-wise, all recyclable.
But what percentage of the total plastic would that be?
That's a good question. I think it's something around 50 to 60%. It's more than half, I'm pretty sure. And the recycling rate, though, that we're going is the figure that I saw for about 1990 are about 0.8%. More recent figures for 94 or so are around 3%. Compared to recycling rates for aluminum and paper, more in the 30 to 60% range. But the process is much simpler, and hopefully going through this we'll see perhaps why. Any other?
Are there any major resins that are in major use that are not petroleum based, synthesized from petroleum product?
Natural rubber is synthesized from a rubber tree, which produces a molecule called isoprene, and that has a very low use since the advent of synthetic rubber, which has superior properties and longevity. But that's one. Starch, cellulose, some polyesters are non-petroleum based, but for the most part, they're all petroleum based.
So what percentage would be petroleum based? Like 80-90% or something?
Maybe 95%.
95, yeah.
Something like that. But that may change as we get more sophisticated in dealing with what I'm sort of trying to think about as an ecosystem of a production cycle. So if we take these resins, how do we end up making a plastic like this? Because the word plastic you mentioned, if you, in some of the other sessions, I've talked about three basic types of plastics. There's a thermal set, a thermoplastic, and a rubber or elastomer. And remember the basic differences for a few who have been here? Okay, our first quiz. a thermal set is something that is a plastic or polymer material which forms a chemical bond between everything that you can't heat and get it to be a rubbery material and sort of squish out of the way and reprocess. It's something that once you heat, after it sets, has to thermally decompose. It basically have to burn it. Heat it up so the bonds will break, chemical bonds. A thermoplastic is something like this where you heat it, it'll get soft, you can then squish it into a machine and extrude it again and reshape it into another product.
Only with heat? The whole process is done with heat on that second one?
For the most part, yeah.
And you can make a different kind of shape container out of it?
Mm-hmm. You can heat it. It gets to be a little tricky because of some other properties, but the things that you put in this to make the plastic originally are still in there. We talked about the Challenger's O-rings, those rubber O-rings, and going through the transition from a rubber to a glass. Sometimes when manufacturers are making things, and usually PVC pipe, the wastewater piping, is usually the plastic that gets the most things added to it. There may be applications where you want it to be a little bit more flexible, and if it's too rigid, in the temperature range you want to work with, people, what they do is add something called a plasticizer to make it more plastic or more deformable. And in PVC, the rates of adding plasticizer to it can be from 5 to 50%. Very high rates of plasticizer in there. Most of the production, I think, is more in the area of 5 to 10% of plasticizer. And that's a small chemical, small molecule that's added to this very large synthetic molecule that shifts what temperature that material will change from a rubber to a solid at. And so if you need to work in South Dakota in the winter, it gets kind of cold, and so they might use a little different grade of PVC, so it'll be able to stay sort of flexible at colder temperatures. So they add this to it to lower that temperature. Other things they add to plastics include things like stabilizers. If you have a plastic that's going to be in the sun for a long time, UV light is not only damaging to people and animals and plant life, but it can be damaging to a plastic. That light that's in the UV range has a very high energy. It's much smaller compared to X-rays and gamma rays, but that light will hit these molecules and actually cause bonds to break in there. If you've ever seen a PVC or polystyrene that's been left out in the sun for a year or something, you'll notice that it gets white and probably has little brittle cracks in it. And that's because you're just degrading the material and it's falling apart. So what they do is add molecules that are small that specifically absorb light from this UV range and disperse that into sort of thermal energy and don't end up breaking as many chemical bonds so that it can last and last and last. And that's good if you want to keep the product going and it still has usable life. Once it runs out of its usable life, then it becomes more of a problem because it is harder to reuse in some sense. Other things, they put flame retardants into the plastics. They put what are called biocides. If you don't want a fungus to grow in there, or you don't want insects to eat it or animals to eat it or something. But those are really more of the biological based or naturally occurring polymers. And some organisms would eat or digest that type of naturally occurring plastic, and so they sometimes add things like biocides to plastics. The example I've been using is they also add colorants. Tide is probably not going to be too excited about selling Tide in a clear liquid bottle because they lose their market share because you're walking down there, you want to see the Tide color, just pick it up and not read the label. And there's a lot of marketing that's dependent upon product appearance. And so they add colorants. You can imagine when they want to recycle these, the kind of color you would end up with is sort of a brownish, greenish, very not marketable color if you're Tide again. So Tide perhaps wouldn't be as interested in remarketing that unless they could clean up the color. So what they do is they take these resins and all these additives and mix it up in a powdery form or sometimes a liquid form, and then they process this into containers. There's a number of different processing methods. There's something called extrusion, molding, calendaring, and coating. They're just different ways to take this material, and generally thermoplastics, and getting it to a high temperature, squishing it through some sort of device into a shape that you would like to have it, and then cooling it, and then popping it out of the mold and printing the label on it. And extrusion was first used, at least the first record of, is in the late 1700s when they were making one of the first modern conveniences, lead pipe. They made an extruder for lead pipe so they could use it for plumbing and water supplies, and weren't very aware of environmental problems having to do with heavy metals. But that was the first real time they used extrusion. It was somewhat used in the 1800s with gutta percha, which is a naturally occurring rubber to make threads and stretchable products, and also some, what was the other thing? They're made of pipe that was out of some strands and then some the cellulose. So it was cut gutta percha and cellulose with an extrusion method. And the way I like to talk about it, if you've seen these Play-Doh fun factories, you know, if you've had any kids, you take a little Play-Doh and you put it in this spot, and then you take the handle and you squish it through this thing that you can slide around. You have different pieces you can squish through. You can make little pipes and I-beams or, you know, little things for artsy crafts stuff. And that's essentially all extrusion is. You have a high-pressure system that pushes a resin through a die, and those little things that you stick in the end of the Play-Doh fun factory are done. In industrial settings, we call those dies, D-I-E. And so you can just adjust the shape. If you then have a continuous feed, you can make long, long pipes or make electrical wire for doing wiring. You send the copper wire through the center and put a plastic insulating coating on the outside.
How do you get the hole in the pipe? You preserve the hole in the pipe.
That's the tricky part. But generally, they'd have the center of the pipe be connected from the back, and the die would fit over a protrusion, and the squished material would come out in that cylinder, so there wouldn't have to be a line in there. They have all sorts of extruders. They have something called, you know, they're sort of a batch extruder, where you just, like the Play-Doh fun factory, you stick a bunch in there and you squish it through there. Or they have what's called a screw extruder. There's a screw that stays in place and turns, just like Da Vinci's wheel for a pump. But the distance between the wall and the screw gets smaller and smaller because that increases a force on that makes the material easier to process. And then it's fairly high temperature and liquidy when it gets squished through this die and cools rapidly, forming the material. And sometimes they need to add other additives to make it go through these extruders easily, and some lubricants and things like that, so it doesn't stick to all the machinery. So it's really a complicated stuff. If you compare this to making an aluminum can, where your goal in life there is to get as pure of aluminum as you can and make the can, sometimes they put a coating on the inside, but the aluminum goal of making the recycled aluminum is to make it as pure as possible. So they heat it up. They can either use a number of different types of metallurgical processes and make it very pure. But when we make plastics, we make it very mixed up and dirty, in a sense. So it's very complicated in the number of things that are in it. Other things, molding, just if you think of, sometimes you have these cookie molds, you know, I make cookies with my daughter, you stick them in these little molds, you can do the same thing with plastics. Generally cups or things like this are what you might call vacuum molded. Well, there'll be a sheet of plastic that's flat over a hole with a mold in it, and they put a vacuum under this and then heat up the plastic so it's liquidish or sort of will move. It comes down and sort of adheres to the mold. They let it cool and pop it out. Some of those, especially polypropylene, if you're to put it in an oven above its glass transition temperature, it has memory of the shape it was before and will go back to that shape. It's kind of amazing property for a material. Other things that are, there's just many different ways to process this. Coating, you can, many books, if you look at this polymer technology in science, the shiny coating on there is a plastic coating on the paper. National Geographic. Let's see. You ever get these and just take them out of the wrapper? And do you smell something when you take these out of the wrapper? There's a solvent that's still coming off of them from the coating process. And I haven't run it through our instrumentation at the chemistry department, but my nose tells me it's something called toluene, which is a solvent. It's hard to, you know, assess the impact of it, but you know, it's something that probably don't want to smell a lot, but in the process, all these glossy pages have a thin coating of plastic on them, and so it's really pervasive. Almost everywhere it's being used for very useful things that people generally like to see. But then there gets to be a very challenging process to reclaim that.
Well, originally, wasn't that shiny paper had high clay content in it? The shiny finish, I think it did.
It could.
Before the plastics became shiny.
Yeah, it could have.
Because there were certain types of papers that were shiny. If you tried to burn them and to dispose of them, were very difficult to fire off.
But is this process then now used on a lot of magazines, or is like you showed National Geographic, was that like the first?
Oh, no, just because I happen to have one.
Oh, okay. So it's
I'm not thinking on that.
So it's typically used on magazines.
Yeah, as far as I understand, yes.
Which means that when they go into landfills, then the plastic is going to preserve it even longer than what they used to do.
Potentially. It depends on the quality of the paper they used and coated it over. If the paper has a fairly high acid content, it'll, in a sense, eat itself up.
Oh.
And there's a number of problems with many books that were published in the last, 30 to 60, 70 years, where they were printed on paper that had a fairly high acid content. And many libraries are finding books that have, you know, published in, you know, say 1920, they open up and they're starting to crumble because of that. They're starting to go through and remove the acid from those, but it's a very laborious and tedious process. So we're sort of at the point of making this stuff. So the next, I sort of wanted to set the stage for that part and then go on to what's the process of recycling it? And and if you've been to any of Dan Spencer's sessions in earth and ethnic stewardship issues, there's some interesting parallels going between that and recycling and ecosystems and looking at cycles. But I think what I'd just like to do is sort of put on the board here as a chemist, I'd say a flow chart, if I'm an biologist, I'd say an ecosystem. But trying to think about sort of birth to death or cyclical use of a resource, in this case, plastic. So if we take some raw resource from the earth, petroleum-based products or something. A producer will take that and make a product, and consumer will purchase that product for either some active or passive reason. Either they want the stuff in the product or they want the product because of its property. And the consumer will use this, and eventually, at least in the past, that ends up going back to the earth, you might say, in a rather odd sense, in a landfill, which is by design a rather hermetically sealed envelope, devoid of light, oxygen, and water, so that things can't really decompose by design, and primarily for health and groundwater contamination purposes. But the other possibilities of taking the materials, in this case plastics, and doing something with them, other things that are being done, one is sort of incineration, and if an incinerator is working properly and they're burning it at a high temperature, can you see this okay? You'll, in a sense, recycle out the water, carbon dioxide, maybe some hydrochloric acid, a few other things if it's working properly. If you're not burning an incinerator at proper temperature, you can do a little bit more chemistry than you perhaps would like to be doing and make some cyclical molecules of chlorines and related to dioxins and things like that. But operated properly, they can produce fairly clean output. And plastics, since they're made from petroleum, have a fair amount of energy value. And so you can reclaim some of the heat. Carbon dioxide goes back into the Earth's system. We might add some more global warming material to the atmosphere, some CO2. And so, there's a number of considerations there. Other things that are possible, we can send things to a recycler. They can then reprocess that. And the producer could then perhaps take input from the recycler, and we start to form the basis of perhaps a more traditional ecosystem if we use the natural world as a model for that. Let's see, the other, add a couple more here. Spell.
Is there anybody that's taking plastic containers and just cleaning them and recycling them that way? Using them over again?
No. Not that I know of.
I don't know.
Labels and stuff.
Well, why would that be the case? Are they porous, or do they, not cleanable in some ways?
But
compared with glass, for example?
Well, especially if we take glass, and let's limit it to beverage containers. And most beverage containers that used to be glass, when I was a kid, I worked at the grocery store, and we hauled all these six-pack of 32-ounce bottles for pop around, and and dropped them, and all sorts of things. But those you could wash fairly easily. They were a fairly good industrial process that you could raise the temperature up to remove any biological contamination, so that you could sterilize them, run them through what are called autoclaves, or like a Hobart, so it gets up to the temperature that kills organisms. Most plastics, because of some of the properties, if you take, I didn't bring my pop bottle, but the polyethylene bottle, and the PET, the pop bottles, they have a glass transition temperature at 80 degrees Celsius, which is about 160, 170 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. And so if you were trying to sanitize those by heat, then you would end up melting your plastic, and so you would have to have a chemical sanitation system, which might end up leaving more residue in there that you wouldn't want to have that would affect the taste. So some of the properties that actually make plastics very energy efficient to produce, because you need very little heat compared to recycling glass, you save a lot of energy but then you also lose in a sense because you can't wash it and reuse it that way.
Using something like a drinking bottle, plastic drinking bottle, something that's a little heftier than a pop bottle. Can something, and those, some of those are dishwasher at least, mm-hmm. not safe, so they have to handle a little bit of heat.
Yeah, the high density.
What prevents people from reusing those in the way that they would use glass?
I don't know if I really have a good answer. Ideas might be FDA regulations. When you heat plastics up, these things that you added to them have a higher propensity to leave the plastic. And so that might draw out more of the things that you put in there, and some of those may not be things you'd really want to eat.
That's why we're not supposed to heat stuff in a microwave in a plastic container.
Yeah.
This stuff will come out of it with the heat.
Well, I think certain things that's really true. Other things that I don't know, and I think people are starting to investigate that. There's a book that's just come out recently. It has a little bit to do with plastics, but it's called Our Stolen Future, where they're looking at endocrine disruption of the various hormone cycles in male and female reproductive chemistry. And there's some concern that some of the things used in plastics and some pesticides and things like that may be contributing to that. And that's a fairly new thought process, and not a lot is known about it. So at least a week or two before I came here, the Chemical Manufacturers Association was investing about $850 million in research to try to learn more about that. But so things especially that weren't meant to be heated, I think that's really true for microwaving. So if you have old margarine containers, they were designed to be used in a refrigerator. And if you heat them, then they might be releasing things that you maybe wouldn't want them to. Things that were designed for microwaves, probably they've thought about, the FDA has probably thought about, but it's, and certain things like this, you don't know until sometimes a problem shows up what implications it may have. But I think sort of a judicious look at that is very reasonable and appropriate. And there perhaps are some things that might be causing some problems, but it's not overly well understood, perhaps, or it's a hard question to answer right now.
I have another question about mm-hmm. incineration. Are there in plastics commonly metallic additives that could be a problem for incineration or things of that sort?
I don't know of any.
There isn't ever any reason to put mixed metals in with plastics.
The only
there isn't synthetic rubber.
In synthetic rubber, where they have tires. May have a steel belt in them. Some fungicides and biocide type materials are based on zinc or copper. We were talking about that yesterday in our hike. And some, I don't know if they're used as much today, but I've read some references to using copper-based compounds or zinc compounds to reduce funguses growing on more than naturally occurring plastics. But for the most part, it's really organic type molecules that are added to plastics. And it's sort of stabilizers, I think of like they're the plastics vitamins. If you have your antioxidants, vitamin A and E and C, things like that, they're meant to help reduce oxidation and free radical problems in plastics, much the same way they work in our body. And there are a few groups that are trying to devise alternative additives that are more biologically or naturally occurring, based in the natural synthetic world. So they're easier to break down and also perhaps less of a problem to people or other things. So the, let's see. So the question I sort of want to get at here is to complete this loop and sort of to make it more of a true ecosystem, so we have to take less raw material and take put into that loop and take less raw material out into the landfill is recycling. And this is sort of the part of the loop that we're thinking about. We could add another step here, sort of for the municipality. And that sort of sorting, collection, things like this. And then this is the processing part. And right now, because of the vast number of resins and the things that are added to plastics, only a few, at least in the US, resins, a lot of other reasons too we'll get to, but there's not a tremendous amount of recycling. But I'd like to just go through the process and see how you actually take a plastic and then give it back to the product. Oh, and let's also add to this, once you get this recycled material back to the producer, they then need to produce a product that may be different. This might be a recycled product. And this might be with the original. And the consumer has a choice in there if they want to use a material that's made from recycled material. And in some cases, if the properties aren't quite as useful as the raw material, then people may choose to use the original product because it suits their usefulness better. Also, oh, what was I just going to say? the cost. Let's probably hold that off until we get a little farther. Well, any questions on this?
I was going to say, an example of that, you know, where the choice, that when you were talking about the Tide liquid detergent bottle, you know, and now you can buy the refills, and where they say, you know, keep your original bottle, which has your measuring cap, and it is a lot cheaper to buy the refills to pour into. And this makes sense because that refill bottle is it isn't a strong bottle, doesn't have the measuring cap on it. But if you keep your original, you know, that's one of the best moves, I think, that they have made in trying to recycle. But I think, I guess I see, you know, my generation, I probably tend to save when you talk about reusing, you know, my children give me a bad time about opening my cupboard, you know, to find something to put a leftover in. It's probably a cottage cheese container instead of the whole set of Rubbermaid or something like that. And I think that just for information or attitude or whatever it is, it's just easier to throw out the Tide bottle and buy a new one rather than keep it and buy the refill bottle.
Right, because landfill costs are fairly cheap, but they're disappearing.
But you still have to recycle a refill bottle.
But it uses less plastic.
It's a different number. It's a
different
one or two.
Plastic and it uses less.
But in different countries, don't you carry a container to the... I've been in countries where you go to some place and buy a big bucket of beer and carry it home in the container that you carry to the beer place. Same with milk, same with wine.
Well, a lot of co-ops, food co-ops, work that way, where you bring your container, and then you can use it, reuse it yourself many, many times, and there's much less packaging with that, too.
I think a nice wooden container, it sounds like it has all the properties.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of pros and cons in all of these. And some of these... like Tide or fabric softening things. Some of them are making the refillable containers out of things that aren't really recyclable. And so that's actually causing more problems too.
Yeah.
So there has to be sort of this holistic approach in some sense, if you want to make that happen.
Are you going to talk about number one and number two, and what, I don't know what those designation means, whether they're based on their resin that's used? Or
yes.
Why?
Yeah, we can.
Yeah, that's some of the most frustrating things, because some things, they look alike. And our city only, you know, we have curbside pickup, but it'll only take one and two. And I can't find a place that'll take three, four, five, or six.
Yeah.
Or ours, for a while, take one or two, it was shaped like a duck. Mm-hmm. It was shaped like the frosting, you know, like a frosting, they would take it. And it would still be a one, but they wouldn't take it. And when we, you know, some people call it just a spare dollar deal, right? But they don't want to take the time to sort it. They know that those particular jugs are one, and they don't always know what those other things are going to be. They don't want to take the time to look at the number.
And it's even more complicated than just the one, because if it's a one, but it contained motor oil or it contained detergent, then the FDA has been reluctant to put that back in a food stream recycling program. And so many recycling programs will only take ones or twos which you drank something from. So if you drink motor oil, then you're sort of... At least I think if you normally drink something that's meant to be drunk, then that's what they will take because of FDA regulations. But the coating system, one is polyethylene terephthalate. Many of these names are the true common chemical manufacturer names. And so that sort of need to have a chemistry degree to get much out of that. But basically, this is related to it. It's a polyester in some sense, like the old polyester clothes that we try to forget about. Where high density polyethylene is number two. Actually, clothing has gotten much better for the plastic production. Yesterday on my hike up to Holden Lake, I was wearing boots that had Gore-Tex in them, which is, and a nylon, which is very useful for my feet. But then trying to, we have all these other issues about what to do with that when that's reached its useful life. Number three is a vinyl chloride. It's a lot like this, but on every other, each black bead here is a carbon atom. Every other carbon atom, instead of having two hydrogens, has one hydrogen and one chlorine molecule attached to it. And that's the difference. Polyethylene is just this type of molecular structure with hydrogens on every spot it can be attached on a carbon atom.
You can't throw them all in the same vat and heat it up and expect that they're going to come out separately.
Right.
That would be nice if it worked that way, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there's a Center for Plastics Recycling at Rutgers University where they're trying to do things like that. Take six or seven different resins, grind them up, put them in either some sort of solvent and precipitate them and separate them so you can remove them. But the problem with, another problem with getting these molecules separated or trying to mix them. When we talked yesterday, we talked about the structure that these large synthetic molecules take up. And I drew on the board this sort of spaghetti-like structure. It's really a random-ish coil. If we were to take a microscope that was really powerful, which we don't have, and look down at the atomic level, we'd see this plate of spaghetti. All these molecules are interwoven. And if you put another kind of plastic or polymer in together with, say, if you take the number one and number three, and try to mix them, thermodynamically, if you look at the energy of interaction between these molecules, the entropy and the energy, they don't want to mix. Because to mix, they have to change the disorders, essentially the thermodynamics, and they don't want to mix for the most part. And so it's very hard to mix them. You have to add sort of, you might think of a glue or a compatibilizer to get them to go together. And that's where the co-mingled waste stream of plastics is developing, where you're making things like planks and decking and picnic benches from those. which are a conglomeration of plastics that are stuck together with compatibilizers and ends up having a once through recycling, which is better than none, but it's not a continuous loop or that type of recycling. So the others are a low density polyethylene, which is like a sandwich bag, and which reminds me of more processing ideas, sort of on the fascinating kind of side of low density polyethylene. If you take a sandwich bag, you take your finger, you can poke a hole in it, right? Without much work, sometimes unfortunately. But that is made out of the same material that this envelope is made out of. And I don't know, does someone want to pull on this?
Same material, huh?
Same material. Now, how could that be?
Oh, we could hold the sound.
Those bears would be frustrated. But the reason it's different is because of the way it's processed. At least this was processed in the past in a sort of an unfriendly environmental method, but the process is this. You take polyethylene, you dissolve it into a solvent, and the solvent happened to be in the past freon. And so what they would do is they take the plastic, mix it with freon, but freon's normally a gas at room temperature. So what they do is they compress it to really high pressures and it converts to a liquid. And so you have this very concentrated polyethylene freon solution. At high pressure, they poke a hole in it, this container. They come squirting out, making all these little fibers. And as it goes from a very high pressure to a very low pressure, that solvent vaporizes. And in the process of vaporizing, it forms these little domains where there's sort of loops of material and structures, sort of like Velcro. And so it squirts out this fiber and then stamp it down and it interlocks among itself, among the fibers, creating something that was much stronger than it could have been if you made a film like a sandwich bag. And that's primarily just a physical difference, not a chemical difference. But, and that illustrates, you know, the utility of plastics and why they're really useful. Let's see. Getting back on these numbers.
And that's polyethylene?
Yeah.
High density?
I don't know if it's high density or low density. I'm not sure. Number five, polypropylene. Is used, polypropylene is a little bit more resistant to, a little more resistant to solvents and caustic chemicals, so you quite often will see cleaning containers made from polypropylene, or sometimes polyethylene terephthalate, number one up there. And that's another confusing thing, because you could go buy a yogurt container, and one might be made out of high-density polyethylene, the other might be made out of polypropylene. And you know, you have to really look at the number to tell the difference, because they can be used for the same thing, and it really depends on the processing, how they're made, what the manufacturer thinks is easiest at the time, I guess, or cheapest. And the last, the polystyrene, which I've got a molecule.
Can I raise a question? You mentioned recycling the different types of containers.
Uh-huh.
At a recycling place, how do they separate all these things into proper characteristics? Number that appears on the bottom of the can? Or
I'm glad you asked.
What?
That's the next topic.
Was it?
Yeah. Trying to get to. No, that's a good leading question. I'm teaching you. Just help people ask the question. Well, anyway, I'm sort of getting off the subject, but then the polystyrene has a different structure. If you see, this is the, if you follow these little black dots along, that's the same thing as this, except on every other black bead, you have one of these benzene-type molecules hanging off the side. By adding those, that changes the properties drastically, and you now have polystyrene, which will go from a glass to a liquid at about the boiling point of water. So they're incredibly diverse and complicated in terms of their molecular structure.
But all of the ones above that are this sort of linear monocule?
They're pretty much all linear.
Would you call that a linear monocule?
Yes.
That's sort of an indefinite length. I mean,
It goes on.
As long as it, until it breaks or until it stops.
Yeah, it depends on how it was made. Yesterday I described that if we had, say, a polymer with a common molecular weight or common size and stretched it out end to end and made the distance between here 1 centimeter, it would be 1 centimeter high and 0.5 kilometer long. And so you can see how long these molecules are. And because of that, we get very amazing properties, and that's why they're useful in some sense. In some sense, so hard to recycle. Okay, well, let's see, how are we doing? Oh my goodness. Is it 11:30? In the last few minutes, I'll just start talking about the process, reprocessing of these. So your question, how do they sort these things? There's a number of ways, and it depends on, either the consumer, when they try to recycle their materials, will sort them. They'll look at the number, put the ones here and the twos here, and you'll realize that pretty much in America, usually only ones and twos are recyclable. Polyethylene terephthalate and high-density polyethylene. There are machines that can scan and look for certain kinds of plastics and decide if it's PVC or if it's polystyrene. They're fairly expensive. Sometimes they have cameras that study the shape of the object as they go by a conveyor belt and say, oh, this is a pop out. It pushes this one off into this bin. Oh, this is a... Right, because their machine has to either look at the shape and decide what it is. The other method is just having a bunch of people sitting in a warehouse, just like we do at the Garbo dock. Just sorting this from this and this and this and this, and putting them into piles. And it's very laborious, and a lot of labor is involved in that.
Labor intensive.
Yeah.
There's no way to detect what kind of, what the material is by instrument.
Yeah.
To do that quickly on that.
There are some. If they're sorted before they go into the, if they have a known possibility of containers, then they can use UV light or X-rays to decide if this is PVC or if this is polyethylene or if this is polystyrene, and then sort of kick them out of the conveyor belt. But it's hard to, you have to have the shape right, have the imaging area right, the size and amount of mass. So the sorting process can be quite complicated. The most useful one from the collection point of view is to have a consumer sort them based on some set of directives. But then you get people who are very happy to do this, or you get people who, we'll just throw this in too, it's number one anyway, you know, what difference does it make? And that can really throw off the recycling process, because what happens then after they're sorted, they have to go to a reclamation plant where they're either chopped up into little pieces. And if you add two together, then you lose the quality of the resin, and the producer won't buy it because it won't hold up to their specifications. Other ways of doing this is they're freezing these with liquid nitrogen, and as we saw, they get very brittle, and you can chop them into fine powder and then use them. It might have a little bit more value that way.
Well, they ask you to take the caps off
and
things too, because the cap is made of something different than the
bottle. And the cap might have a tin foil coating on the inside, or might have a paper coating. Many new caps now are just made out of one component. Sometimes the cap will be polypropylene, and the container will be a high-density polyethylene.
Don't you think it's all going to come down to where we're only going to be able to be allowed to make our containers out of one plastic? I mean, the choices have to go away as we continue to grow in population. We seem to want to grow in population, because I notice everybody still has kids and grandchildren, great-grandchildren. But I think the choices have to come down to where, hey, if you want a milk bottle, you make it out of this. If you don't, you go to jail.
Well, see, you're getting now into social structures and politics and various... This is such a diverse thing. It brings in personality, it brings in tradition, it brings in expectations, it brings in science and technology, It's just incredible the variety. And right now, America's not really in the mood to do anything governmentally wise. You know, if we say I'm going to have another governmental regulation, well, my goodness, we're just going to go to anarchy and that's all. You know, which, you know, the motivations for recycling are going to be that landfill costs are getting. Let's just sort of end with one thing, and I can be happy to stick around for a while too, but just so people feel comfortable with taking off the end of the hour. This is a couple of graphs. So just think about the cost of landfills. Legislation mandates may influence recycling, and marketing of recycled products, and the cost of oil. And so this graph, these graphs we see here really look at cost of landfills versus the cost of oil. This is a barrel of oil at $20. This is a barrel of oil at $35. And this dashed line indicates sort of the viability and unviability of recycling from an economic point of view, and that's a traditional economic point of view, not including only traditional costs, not costs of raw resources and things like that. So this is the cost of the collection, the sorting, the money you didn't have to pay the landfill to take the stuff, and the money you could get from the producer to take your recycled material. And at current landfill costs, we're somewhere in this area right now, $20 to $50 to $100. And to recycle PET, it's a very profitable thing to recycle HDPE, high-density polyethylene, milk jugs and pop bottles. Those ones that contain beverages are very easily recyclable at a modest profit, so someone could invest in that and get a return back on their investment, and so there's a lot of incentive to do that. You get to non-beverage containers, even if they may be PET or high-density polyethylene, the cost starts to go up.
Like oil
cans or bottles now. Whereas if we go to, well, also as you see, when landfill prices increase, much more becomes viable. Also, if we go up to this one, if we go to a higher oil cost, then non-beverage containers come down almost to the point where if you combine it with landfill costs up in the over $100 cost, then you start to add non-beverage bottle container recycling as an economically viable thing. And still, all other packaging, plastic packaging costs still are way up above there in terms of recycling, in terms of what I would call the traditional economic approach to the costs. Because we don't put a value really on raw materials. Quite often don't have a value. The carbon dioxide put back in the air doesn't have an economic value. We're starting to have pollution futures in the Chicago Board of Trading, I think, but there's not. Trying to treat the whole cycle economically has been very challenging. Okay. It's about 11:30, so I thank you for coming. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to stay.
What are you going to do tomorrow?
Tomorrow I'm going to get a little controversial. I'm going to show a videotape from the American Plastics Council and see if we can think about what arguments they're using in plastics recycling and environmental things. And a couple of people want to say some provocative things and see if we can analyze some of the arguments and the benefits and the costs of using plastics, or the blessings or the curses. And one of the assignments I've sort of been giving people this week is I would like you to think about everything you touch in the course of a day that's plastic or a polymer or a rubber. And think about how you would go about making a judgment whether you would want to do without that or not. If you have contacts, if you have glasses, shoes, anything, think about all the places that you come across plastic. If you try to live a day without touching a plastic and see how you can do that. And then sort of talk about the issues of in some of the sense of what Dan Spencer is talking about, how do we take a reform mind and try to change the way we're doing things so we can keep some of the advantages, or do we take a radical approach and throw everything away, or do we try to, what is the approach that would lead to better stewardship of our position in your ecosystem. So, I realize you're